are listening to the cycling podcast at the Tour de France in association with Rafa, the fastest closing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as a partner EF Education First and Canyon Charam.
Where are we, Lionel?
We're in the Bedford Hotel in Paris, the morning after the final stage of the Tour de France. It's all over, Richard. Time to go home.
It's all over, Francois.
It is, yeah. Strange, isn't it?
We all go our separate ways today. It's been a fabulous 3 weeks, but before we go, we have our press conference episode. Much of this was recorded on our drive yesterday from the Alps up to Paris. Some great questions came in, very international in terms of the listeners who asked questions. So thank you very much, everybody who sent questions, who's been listening to the podcast and giving us feedback over the last 3 weeks. It's been a wonderful 3 weeks, hasn't it? We don't have a tale of the étape. Can we have, I don't know, a tale of the petit déjeuner?
Well, if you want, yeah, I can recommend the Bedford Hotel, actually, if you're having a short break in Paris. It's pretty reasonably priced for Paris. The breakfast is very nice.
Is this a sponsor message?
No, we paid for this hotel, and we had already been paid for before we got here. I think we've still got to settle up for breakfast and the beer I may have had whilst watching the tour on the telly before we went out to the team buses last night. But yeah, very close to the Place de la Concorde. A lovely morning run I had along the Seine and back. Lovely location. And even Francois was very impressed with this.
Yeah, the restaurant hall is like very art nouveau as well, you know, like the end of the 19th century with a kind of rotunda glassware. No, really, really nice little place. Very cozy and quiet as well, which is rare in the center of Paris.
I should say, Richard, you chose and booked this hotel, so the credit is all yours, obviously.
Thank you. Well, before we crack on with some listeners' questions, let's say a thank you before we hear the sponsor message. A big thank you to Rafa, our headline sponsor, without whose support we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't have been here the last few years. Very, very grateful to them. They are wonderful partners for us. So let's hear the Rafa message for the last time, and then on with the questions.
The fastest closing in a world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as a partner EF Education First and Canyon Charam.
Hi, Cycling Podcast. This is Ewan Munro here from Edinburgh. I'm loving the Tour de France coverage. I just wanted to ask a little bit about modern sprinters like Caleb Ewan. So, as mentioned in the podcast, people like Caleb don't need a full lead-out train, and they're described as modern sprinters. Do you think there can be a case where all the sprinters in a field are going to be like that and not require a lead-out train? And what do you think is going to happen at the end of these sprint stages if that is the case?
Thank you very much for your question, Ewan, and your kind comments. I mean, there's always been a bit of a mix, hasn't there? There'll never not be lead-out trains because there are teams in whose interest it is to set up a bunch finish. And if there isn't at least one team on the front keeping the pace high, there won't be a bunch finish. So there will always be a team, I think, prepared to do that. And that effectively becomes a lead out. You know, we hear there are other, you know, Mark Cavendish had a very effective lead out train, but then there are times when he didn't need a lead out train. And most of these guys are not only fast, but very good bike handlers, and they've got great spatial awareness, and they're very skillful. The one guy who I think does need a lead-out train is Marcel Kittel, whose background is a little bit different maybe to other sprinters. He's a big guy. He's maybe not got the jump, but he needs the sprint to be as long as possible. And I'm not sure that he's as confident a bike handler in bunch sprints as some of the other people. He needs kind of clear road in front of him. And I think that's been a big factor sometimes in his inability to get results. If he's not in the right position to win, he can't win. He started off his career as a time trialist, of course. So he came to sprinting pretty late and maybe didn't develop those skills that some of these other guys have developed when they're younger.
Well, I think these things go in cycles according to the types of riders and the types of teams that are available. You know, the idea of the lead-out train and who invented it is, up for debate. But, I mean, certainly in the mid to late 70s, the Belgian Flandria team used to mass at the front to give Freddie Martins a lead-out. Or certainly when Sean Kelly first turned professional, one of his jobs was to be at the front helping keep the pace high with the likes of Mark de Meyer and co. Then, you know, from my own time watching cycling, you know, Super Confex in the late 80s, 87, 88, they set things up very much for Jean-Paul Van Poppel, and they did so because they didn't have a rider for the overall classification. That was the one area of the Tour de France that they could excel at. Then came the Seiko team, Mario Cipollini. It made perfect sense for them to mass at the front and lead out Cipollini. And then the Cavendish years were really because HTC Colombia took a view that they could get the most bang for their buck because they had the fastest sprinter in the world, and well, why wouldn't they put all of their resources into leading him out? Whereas things are a little bit different at the moment. I think that it's one of the subtle impacts of the teams coming down to 8 riders from 9 riders in the Tour de France. It means that there's perhaps not the willingness to put every resource into a sprinter who may only have 3 or 4 opportunities to win a stage in the race. So we see these things kind of shift and change. You know, the trends come and go, I guess.
Mm. From, you know, my recollection of things, Lionel, you mentioned the kind of recent history of sprinting. The real procession of, you know, 9 riders leading their leaders and pulling out one after the other until the lead out man kinds of propels the rocket to into orbit is quite new. It's for me, even you mentioned Van Poppel and other guys, the lead out man has always been there. The real lead out train with, like, you know, a whole team dedicated to that task, I think, is more Cipollini. And then, you know, the inspiration from Cipollini meant that the 90s and noughties were the golden age of the sprinter's train. But in the old days, the André Darrigade and guys like this, I mean, they sprinted pretty much the way Caleb Ewan sprints. It is, you know, you look for the wheel of the guy who seems the more dangerous for you, and you overtake him at the last, at the last minute, which is actually the technique that's been used on track. On the track, you don't have lead out trains for sprint because there's only 2 guys. They are or even in carrying. So the guys who have these track abilities and skills, I think, don't really need necessarily trains. Lead out men, I think, have been there almost forever. Trains are more. More the 90s and the noughties. So maybe we're coming back in a way these days, and possibly thanks to the reduction of teams to 8, to actually what is old school sprinting.
Hello, Richard, Lionel, and Francois. Andrew Backhouse from New Zealand here. Thanks for all your work on my favourite podcast with its heady mix of facts and whimsy. So Daniel can't bear bodily functions, and Francois can't walk over bridges. Another podcaster elsewhere told of being unable to take the cable car to a mountaintop finish. Can you tell us how the Tour or other races have been affected by phobias and superstitions originating from the riders, organisers or journalists? By the way, you read out my name as a friend of the podcast a few days ago, and before that, the name of an old school friend who I hadn't heard of in 30 years. Thanks for that too.
Thank you for your question, Andrew. And, well, that's fantastic if you've been reunited with an old school friend, thanks to us reading out the names at the end of the podcast. And thank you very much for being a friend of the podcast. Francois, I suspect you've got some information on this. One of the stories that I know is about Jacques Anquetil. I can't actually remember which tour it was, but a seer, a kind of fortune teller, a mystic, Jacques Bellin.
Mm-hmm, I think so. Yeah.
Wrote in a newspaper prior to one of the tours that he won that he would die during the tour, and Anquetil became obsessed by this. And there was a rest day in Andorra where he had a barbecue and some wine. And
it was sangria, apparently.
Okay.
Anyway.
And the next day he didn't feel good, and the weather closed in, and on the descent, he became convinced that this was going to be the moment of his death, and he decided, I think, in the end, if I'm going to die, I might as well go out in a blaze of glory. And I presume it was Raymond Poulidor who'd pulled away and was on the verge of winning, and Anquetil got him back and didn't die in that tour.
That's right.
But that sort of was a cloud hanging over him that year. Any other stories like that?
Well, there are. Well, the most common phobia I can think of is the fear of descents. We know that. The first time I heard about this, fear of descents, and someone being treated for it was Jenny Bugno. He was a very good climber, a very good, Grand Tour contender. Was world champion. Is now actually heading the Riders' Trade Union. And he had a real problem, going downhill, and he actually, had a kind of psychotherapy to solve the problem. It was based on listening to classical music, and since the Bugno years, I've heard that story repeated many times of riders having problems in descents. Well, Thibaut Pinot denies that it's the case, but he was mentioned among the riders who had that issue. I remember David Moncoutier, when he was raining in descents, he would crash regularly and had kind of a jinx of that sort. So that phobia of descents is pretty common. It's more for fear than real pure phobia. But I remember a rider was of the Michael Matthews, Peter Sagan type, who was a very, very good Belgian rider who won many, many races, and who had the typical profile of a world champion. His name was Eddie Plancarte, and Eddie Plancarte missed a couple of world championships because of his fear of flying. He would never take planes to go to races, and it might have cost him, who knows, a better career had he flown. So these are among the phobia stories I can remember.
I think Pascal Richard was maybe afraid of flying as well. Urs Zimmermann was reported to be afraid of flying when, in the 1991 tour, there was a transfer from the north of France down to the Pyrenees.
Oh, yeah.
And Zimmermann opted to go by car with the mechanics rather than in the plane with all the riders. And the rules were at the time that the riders had to go in the official transfer.
Absolutely.
And so the following morning, he was disqualified from the race. The riders then went on strike. And with Zimmermann at Pau Airport preparing to fly home, spot the inconsistency there. He was called and went back to the start and took the start and was in the break that day. But the real story, and I went to see Zimmermann a few years later, and apologies if you've heard me say this before on the podcast, because I'm sure I've told the story before. Lionel, are you nodding?
I've heard it.
Okay. I went to see him a few years ago, and the real story was that he said he was just sick of the company of cyclists. And it felt like a prison, and the last thing he wanted to do was spend even a couple of hours on a plane with him. So he fancied the company of the mechanics instead. And that's what he said. He was a very interesting character, Zimmermann.
Phobia of a fellow cyclist. I can understand that.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm starting to develop a phobia of journalists, to be honest.
The other very common superstition is the number 13. We see that turned upside down, so that riders don't wear number 13.
Marcus Burkhardt is number 13, I think, in this tour.
It's not been unlucky for him, has he? He's Pedler de Charme.
But he has got his numbers on upside down.
So we'll do a question that we've been emailed, actually. We do get quite a lot of email questions, but and it's difficult to include them all. We do like to hear your voices, so we tend to favour the phoned-in questions. But we had one that really interested us from Basil Wilson. The subject line is journalistic bias, which was slightly ominous, but we read on. Dear all, time for my periodic rant about inconsequential stuff. Well, I don't think it's inconsequential. Just listen to your excellent Kilometre to Zero with David Walsh, sponsored by Hansgrohe Showers, who also incidentally sponsor the cycling team that you regularly report on. I have a great deal of respect for the journalistic integrity of you all, and have no reason to call this into question. But do you ever have to make difficult decisions when considering a sponsor for the podcast? He cites examples like, for example, Pascal Ackermann, Bora Hansgrohe rider, who made slightly less than assertive pronouncements on doping during the Giro. Did that give us cause to provide a more muted response than we might otherwise have given? Similarly, it's easy to find associations with other areas. Does having a mutual sponsor with Team INEOS and EF Education First, Science and Sport and RAFA, give you pause for thought? I don't believe it would, but do you feel that an association with companies like this would make you more reluctant to cover stories with negative PR effects on those organizations? I guess this is where the commercial realities of the podcast could potentially create conflicts of interest with true journalistic integrity. Do you feel that endorsing any of the brands that sponsor the podcast has created a conflict of interest at any point, and has this prompted discussion amongst yourselves? I rely on you guys to shine an independent and unbiased light on the murkier side of the sport, relatively unbridled by commercial considerations. Basil finishes by saying, I haven't renewed my Friends of the Podcast subscription yet, but I will do. Hope you do, Basil. Thanks very much. I mean, the answer, it's a really interesting question, and it certainly is something that we discuss and have discussed and have done right from the early days, because in the very early days of the podcast in 2013, we were sponsored by Sharp initially. Sharp were a co-sponsor of the Garmin Sharp team, and a few months into our association with them, there was a story about Ryder Hesjedal's doping came to light. And that kind of put his victory at the Giro in 2012 into a slightly different perspective, a different light, because it was presented as one thing and then the reality was something else. Not that he doped to win that Giro, but had we known about his historic doping, it might have altered the way in which we and others covered that story. But when it came to discussing that story, we had to obviously completely disregard our association with Sharp and say what we thought. And we came down pretty hard. We were all of us pretty unimpressed with how, I suppose, Garmin, the team Garmin at the time, had managed the story and the sort of the hypocrisy of presenting Ryder Hesjedal as one thing when he was something else. And we said it as we saw it. We actually then heard from Jonathan Vauters, who, you know, ran the team, and yeah, he was keen to have a right of reply to what we'd said. So we sat down with him and did an interview that we also played in the podcast, which I think was quite an interesting discussion. But it's an ongoing thing. And I think the listeners ultimately will be the judge of whether we cover stories and teams fairly and impartially. And I would say I wasn't at the Giro when Ackerman made those comments, but I did hear Lionel and Daniel discuss it. And I don't think they discussed it in a muted way. I think they were pretty critical, and that they felt, and I remember Daniel making the point that particularly with the history of German cycling, the Ackerman should have said something a little bit stronger.
Yeah, well, what Ackerman said was unsatisfactory in the sort of the broader landscape of cycling and cycling's history with doping. We did cut him a bit of slack in the sense that, you know, he's a young rider. Perhaps hadn't been kind of media briefed on whether to expect that kind of question. But I have to say, and I mean this absolutely sincerely, the fact that Kilometre Zero, sponsored by Hansgrohe, just did not enter my thinking, and pretty certainly didn't, well, I know for certain it didn't enter Daniel's thinking. And it didn't affect what we said. And in actual fact, and I'm not sort of saying we were the only people to comment on this, but because we weren't, but I don't think that particular story of Ackerman's comments would have achieved the breadth of discussion had we not discussed it on the podcast. Had we chosen not to highlight what Ackerman had said in that press conference, I'm fairly sure it would have just kind of, you know, been a footnote. We possibly amplified it, or we gave it the oxygen that the comments deserved from that press conference setting, and we did so without fear or favour, as they say. I would say, as an old school print journalist, as we all are, really, we all started in print journalism, where the Berlin Wall between the advertising department and the editorial department has always been pretty fixed, and you didn't have to dip your toe behind into the advertising department. That was all, you know, separate. You basically didn't know what adverts would be appearing on a page. It wasn't your job to know that. You just wrote your copy, and that was that. The media landscape has changed completely, and it has been a challenge to deliver advertising content whilst maintaining the sort of journalistic integrity that hopefully people listen to us for, as well as all the other nonsense. I hope that the line between advertising and editorial is clear, and I hope that also people know that when we are delivering an advertising message, we're not saying something we don't believe. You know, we are delivering it as honestly and as sincerely as we deliver our journalism. And I guess, you know, when you listen to as many podcasts as I now do, you hear the trends, you hear the changing style of delivery, and obviously, you know, things are continuing to evolve as the podcast market grows up and matures, I guess.
It's worth saying as well that we haven't had any kind of pressure at all from any of our sponsors to, you know, cover the teams that they sponsor in a certain way. On the contrary, we get a lot of feedback from Science and Sport. The chief executive there, Stephen Moon, who we mentioned from time to time. He listens to the show. He'll be listening now. Hello, Stephen. You know, we have over time given Team Sky, of which Science and Sport are, nutrition providers, nutrition partners. We've given them a pretty hard time when they've deserved it. You know, around the time of the TUE story for Bradley Wiggins, the Jiffy Bag story, the interview that we did with Dave Brailsford that was, you know, perhaps didn't do Dave Brailsford and Team Sky too many favours at the time. We've never had any kind of, feedback from Science and Sport or Rafa or anybody else to tell us that we should cover the teams that they sponsor in a certain way, or we shouldn't say certain things. And if we did, the partnership wouldn't last very long, because we clearly can't operate like that. And as I said earlier, the listeners will and do tell us when we get it wrong, because we do get it wrong from time to time. But, you know, we don't get it wrong for these commercial considerations. We sometimes get things wrong because everybody gets things wrong. Don't know if you have anything to add to this.
Yeah, as an outsider, kind of embedded into the cycling podcast, like other colleagues have been embedded in cycling teams to find about their integrity.
Oh, is that what you're here for?
I can tell you one thing. These guys have no integrity whatsoever. They're into it only for the money, and so am I.
That's definitely not true,
Richard. There's an air coming up in 2 kilometers. We could turf Francois out of his nest if you want.
We could, yeah. Hit the eject button, Lionel.
Hi guys, Michael from Croydon, Pearl of the South here. This has been widely hailed as the best tour in ages, particularly after years of Sky suffocation of attacking racing. What do you put that down to? The course design, with lots of medium mountains, an early short TT and the high altitude mountains? The lack of a dominant rider, i.e. Froome, enforcing psychological conservatism on everyone else? Or was it just due to the swagger and charisma of the genius that is Julian Alaphilippe? And what would you like to see happen to make next year's tour just as great? Supplementary question, if I can. Alaphilippe deserves a great nickname. Any suggestions, Lionel? Thanks, guys.
Thank you for your question, Michael. It's a really good question and an impossible one to answer. LeFrancois, in Saturday's podcast, you said, didn't you, that Geraint Thomas had credited Julian Alaphilippe above all other factors?
Yeah, that's right. So, it's a tribute to Geraint Thomas again that, you know, he understands and recognizes that in spite of, you know, Team Ineos finishing 1 and 2 in the race, and they quite deserved to that. I mean, the interest of the race rested on another rider from another team. I think, of course, the course. I asked the question to a couple of guys. I mean, we all asked ourselves that question. I asked the question to a few team directors, and what they said was that a major factor was not to have had a time, an individual time trial late in the race, because usually everybody kind of, if you put a time trial after the mountains, maybe some riders kind of hold back just a little bit because they know that the time trial may be decisive. So to have a time trial in between mountain stages was a brilliant idea. Then we can't entirely say that the high altitude mountains made a difference, because they did in a way, but the course, what should have been the climax of the Tour de France was kind of cut short by, you know, the elements, I mean, the weather conditions. But the strange thing is it made it even more exciting, you know, the fact that however good an organizer you are, or however you know, a good tactician you are as a team or as a rider, I mean, sometimes this is an outdoor sport, and sometimes what all the plans you've made can be, you know, broken. I thought about it yesterday, and nobody seems to have lifted that point. What if Team Ineos had decided not to attack on Iseran like they did, but to wait for the last climb to Tignes? Then Julien Alaphilippe might have won the Tour. So, you know, it's a balance of tactics, course, strategy. But I think I think everybody would agree on that. Cycling is about opportunism, is about seizing your chance when it's there, then to take advantage of the course, of your strength, and to have that tactical sense, that instinct that makes you win.
I mean, it is obviously a bit of everything, but Alaphilippe certainly added an awful lot to it. There was that stage three, which into Epernay, which really suited him down to the ground and was obviously a target for him. And you know, he just carried on from there. I think it's worth saying that the time trial was fantastic. The course was fantastic for the time trial. Just the right balance of being quite long, not too long, and quite challenging and testing, with a couple of climbs and a fantastic finish. And so great credit to the organizers for the time trial. A stage that can sometimes be a bit boring was actually very, very exciting and added a lot to the race. I wonder now, Francois, there's been a suspicion that, you know, that Christian Prudhomme has been designing a route that would suit the Frenchman, in particular Romain Bardet, Thibaut Pinot and Warren Barguil, who are more classical kind of pure climbers. Alaphilippe is a different kind of rider and would, if he was going to concentrate on the Tour, need a slightly different kind of course, a course with fewer high mountains and more medium mountains. And we were sort of talking or speculating this morning about whether, you know, the Tour, instead of finishing in the Alps, the Pyrenees, finished in the Vosges Mountains and had as its final date, meaningful stage on the Saturday, the finish at La Planche des Belles Filles that we had this year with the new kind of dirt road at the end. What a fantastic climax to the Tour that could potentially be. And one that, you know, might, there probably is a course out there that would suit Alaphilippe.
Well, I honestly think that this idea, very, very kind of conspiracy theory, that the Tour organizers are designing courses for the French to win is pure fantasy. Or if it's not pure fantasy, well, they are lousy organizers, because no Frenchman has won it since Christian Prudhomme has designed the Tour de France. So sorry, Christian, but you should change your plans. You so far you missed out totally.
Well, we thought we'd play a couple of interviews in this episode of our press conference episode of the Cycling Podcast at the Tour de France, or after the Tour de France. First one is with Phil Lowe, not a name that will be familiar to most of you, but Phil is the press officer for De Koninck Quickstep. He just started this year, and what a baptism of fire he's had, especially at this Tour de France. If you saw Julien Alaphilippe cross the line in his yellow jersey and be kind of... you know, protected from all the journalists and photographers on the finish line. Generally, it was Phil acting as he says here, as bodyguard as much as press officer, and he would sort of look after him through that post stage protocol of press conferences and traveling to the team hotel, etc. I thought it'd be very interesting to get Phil's perspective on his first Tour de France with De Koninck Quickstep and his experiences with Julien Alaphilippe. Phil, this is your first year as a press officer with the team. And you've had a pretty big job this Tour, yeah. Maybe a more bigger one than you imagined. Yeah. What's it been like being the guy who sort of has to look after Alaphilippe when he crosses the line every day?
Yeah, press officer turned bodyguard, I think. It's been a pleasure. It's been an amazing experience. It has been chaos at times through just his sheer popularity, and then things haven't always been the greatest organisation, but... yeah, I think overall, I look back and say this is something I'm never ever going to forget. It's been good fun. It's been stressful, but yeah.
What's it been like getting to know him, I guess, better as well?
Yeah, and you see both sides, because you see, obviously, when there's a lot of pressure put and he's really happy, and then this time's really stressed as well. And I suppose it's... I'm a fan and I've watched it on TV, but then you see them as people and realise they are just people like us underneath, and they have their ups and downs like all of us.
Did you get to know him quite well?
Yeah, I've got to know him. I think it's hard not to in those situations, and there's times when there's just been me and him in the car and we've got to talk, and then the times when there are other people who do know him a bit better, but we've had jokes, laughs, we've had times when we both wanted to do each other to do something that we don't want to do, and we've had to work at it. But yeah.
As a, I mean, what's he like? Because we see this very jovial character. Is he like that most of the time?
Yeah, I'd say most of the time. I think naturally, with any kind of athlete who's made it to the top of the sport, there's their intense moments as well. And I think part of what I've got is knowing when to leave him alone and when to ask people to back off him when he needs his space. But then there are times when he wants to have a laugh and a joke and be the centre of attention.
Hi guys, I'm Sebastian from Medellin, Colombia. I've been listening to the cycling podcast since the last Giro. I like it very much. It offers me a complete perspective of cycling, and it's not easy to find those kind of information here in Colombia. It's the cycling journalist is more like a football journalist. And it's not very nice, but I want to ask you precisely about which place do you think the cycling world should allow to have to those former dopers or ex-dopers. For example, here we have Santiago Otero participating in the transmission of a TV channel of the tour, and well, that's precisely what I want to ask you. Which place do you think the cycling world should allow these people have in the cycling world?
Thanks for your question, Sebastian. And it's fantastic to hear that we've got listeners in Colombia. And hope you enjoyed the intro to the opener to Saturday's stage, where we heard a Colombian broadcaster commentate on Bernal as he crossed the line and confirmed himself as Colombia's first Tour de France winner. You made the point in that episode, Lionel, about the sort of cultural differences between journalists, in particular from Colombia and other parts of the world. But the question that you ask is about dopers and what to do with them, I suppose. And the question's been asked quite a lot this tour because Lance Armstrong, the controversial Lance Armstrong, has been featuring on NBC's coverage in the US, and there's been quite an outcry about that. But if you look around, there are a lot of former dopers who form part of the TV coverage in various countries. David Miller is a co-commentator on ITV, so it's not restricted to any country in particular. And it's a thorny question, isn't it? I think it's surprising to see Armstrong back on mainstream media. He's sort of been rehabilitating himself through his podcast the last couple of years, and has clearly reached a point now where NBC feel that having him on will enhance their coverage rather than sort of prove too much of a distraction and turn people off.
Yeah, that is a really interesting one, because NBC is a rights holder, an important one for the Tour de France, and I wonder whether there has been any discussion or conversation about whether or not it's appropriate for Armstrong to be on the coverage, because he is effectively banned from the sport, isn't he? He's not allowed to participate officially in any capacity, and while a broadcaster is free and should be free, as the media should be free, to seek opinions from whoever they see fit, with NBC being what the US rights holder for the Tour de France coverage, it's an interesting one, that, and it did surprise me. And I've seen, you know, it's one of these issues where there will be opinions from completely opposite ends of the spectrum, some saying, well, he's got something to offer, something to add, and well, can he be punished any longer, and some saying that you know, Armstrong's presence on the TV coverage still brings the sport into disrepute, and at the risk of getting a thorny behind, or a splintery behind, sorry, I can see both points of view there, really.
But Christian Vandeveld, his former teammate, is also part of the NBC coverage and was part of the case against Armstrong, and in being so, admitted to his own doping. He's on site at the Tour de France, and that's an interesting point you raise, Lionel, because presumably Armstrong couldn't be on site. He wouldn't be accredited by the Tour, just as he wasn't accredited by the Giro when he covered it with his podcast last year.
Yeah, I mean, as you said, Richard, there's lots of former dopers, some of them banned for life in the peloton. Kim Anderson, who is the team director for Trek Segafredo, was banned for life from any cycling activity many years before Lance Armstrong, and he's been in the caravan ever since, with a team director with all the different incarnations of the Trek Segafredo team. Well, Alexander Vinokourov is still the manager of Astana. Richard Virenque is a consultant on various French media and always as popular with the French public. So there is the moral, it's always the same thing, you know, with doping. There is the moral issue and there's a legal issue. I mean, once it's the same for everything outside doping. Once you've served your time, if you've been banned for 2-4 years, you should be allowed back into society. So David Miller, for instance, served his time and came back kind of washed by, you know, serving his time, and he's now, you know, an advocate of anti-doping. Should David Miller be out of cycling? There's no reason why in legal terms. Then it's up actually to the companies who used or employed these guys to see what their morality is. But once again, even for Armstrong and NBC, it's more a moral point of view than a legal point of view. I don't think you can't, Armstrong should be banned from speaking to and working for NBC. Then what's the reason behind NBC's decision to hire Armstrong? Well, in my opinion, it's just a high-profile personality that brings more viewers to the channel, and that's what it is.
What do you think, Richard? I mean, if you think about the UK media, it would be hard to imagine on the BBC's coverage of the Olympics them having somebody who'd been convicted of doping on their sofa offering an opinion. I think I can't think of an example.
Dwayne Chambers.
Well, it's notable that Linford Christie is one of the few sort of Olympic gold medalists who's been just sort of airbrushed out of the picture, and when, you know, London 2012 Olympics were on, he didn't feature at all. Of course, they use, I'm sure they use people who were dopers but were never caught, you know, which is the issue, because we know that that at various times in athletics and cycling's history, doping has been endemic. So we hope that's not the case now, that the sport has changed, but there are certainly lots of people still around and who were involved in different periods in the sport's history. I think it's on a case-by-case basis, isn't it? And I agree with Francois that David Miller is one such example, as is Christian Vandevelde. And then at the other end, you've got unrepentant dopers, I suppose. Not sure if I would include Lance Armstrong among them. I suppose I would. We've got Michael Rasmussen in the press room as well every day. He works for a Danish newspaper. He featured in a Kilometre Zero that you did last year, I think it was, Lionel, or was it 2 years ago, maybe, where, his whole sort of demeanour and his account was pretty jarring for a lot of people, because he offered a perspective on doping, on his own doping, that was completely unrepentant and unapologetic. And so, you know, I'm not saying that he should be banned from covering the race and banned from the press room, but it is interesting that ASO, the Tour de France, accredit Michael Rasmussen and won't allow other riders on the race at all.
Yeah, well, I was just about to say, other things I do in my career as a journalist was covering gangsterism, and gangsters write books and sell lots of books. So should we blame the publishers from giving them a kind of a you know, standpoint, to make them popular in a way. It's a tricky one, you know. So I'm not saying dopers and gangsters are the same, but there is always this tendency to showcase, you know, people who've done wrong in a way. So if gangsters are, you know, allowed to, or ex gangsters who served that time are allowed to write their memories and sell lots of them, actually, I don't see why ex-dopers shouldn't be allowed to do the same. I mean, we're not living in a very moral society from time to time.
Just on Michael Rasmussen, it's a couple of years ago now, but I really enjoyed the challenge of sitting down and talking to him about his own doping and also his media coverage. He works with Brian, who we heard from in the Jakob Fuglsang Kilometer Zero. Brian's a very very warm, friendly guy, always says hello. Rasmussen is a lot more reserved, and we're on kind of eyebrow-raising terms in either the press room or the service stations, wherever we bump into each other. But what I found fascinating about Rasmussen was not only the way he framed his own doping in that Kilometer Zero, which you can go back and listen to if you wish, but also the way that kind of almost infected the way he looks at the sport now, unable to see it beyond his own prism, really, unable to fathom anybody doing anything clean. And yet, when asked what he knew about the current day peloton, I mean, we're talking a couple of years ago, so I don't know whether his coverage style has changed, but he was unable to really offer a great deal in terms of sort of concrete kind of evidence to support the skepticism that he had. It was just it felt a little bit like he'd not been challenged on that too often, and that was interesting anyway.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
Said Piquet, interrupting our press conference episode after the Tour de France to remind us to tell you that we are sponsored by The Economist. The Economist is a smart guide to the forces impacting your world, and if you would like to get a free copy of the magazine delivered to your door, you can do so if you're in the UK by texting the word cycling to 78070. Richard, what has caught your eye in The Economist this week?
An article about which I think you might have more to say than me, Lionel. It's headlined, "Fielding Criticism, Lamenting Cricket's Move to Paid TV is a Silly Point." This does tie into the Tour de France because while in the UK there are some sort of crown jewels of public broadcasting, the Broadcasting Act of 1996 designates certain events to be free to air, Olympic Games, Wimbledon, Football World Cup and the FA Cup being those events. In France, the Tour de France has that status, and it has to be on free-to-air public television. It's been a topic of conversation, though, in the UK concerning cricket, because the last I'm going to get the terminology wrong here, because I don't know cricket very well, but the World Cup final, which was recently held, I believe, was the first...
Won by England, Richard.
It was the first cricket match aired on free television since the Ashes in 2005. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And
yes.
That's quite interesting to me, because I vividly remember the Ashes of 2005, and that really did sort of capture part of the nation's imagination. one of the four nations' imaginations. It was big news, and all the players were recognisable, and that has changed since cricket has gone onto paid-for TV.
And of course, paid TV pays huge money for sporting events. So that is the kind of the thing that sports have to weigh up, and sports events have to weigh up.
And this is the argument being made in this Economist article, that actually the money that governing bodies can get from selling the rights in this way ensures that, you know, it's a balance, isn't it, between eyeballs and cash, hard cash. And the eyeballs might lead to greater participation, investment by people, but the sponsorship money, the TV money, ensures investment, actual hard cash investment in the game now.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting when you think about the Tour de France, which, of course, in the UK is available to watch on both ITV and Eurosport, and is probably, well, certainly the race that captures the imagination most. And if it was not available that widely, people like Geraint Thomas, Chris Froome would be kind of fringe figures in the world of sport.
And you think about how cycling built its audience in the UK through Channel 4,
absolutely.
You know, through nightly programs on Channel 4. So I think there's a good argument for making it free to watch.
And coincidentally, Channel 4 gave up the rights to the Tour de France when they got the rights to the cricket back in, I think, 2000. That's, so, the broadcasters, the sports, and the potential audience, and the money available from the broadcasters, and then the attendant sort of sponsorships is a fascinating puzzle. You're right, Rich. That was a really interesting article, and one that kind of caught our eye because it's about the world of sport. But there's so much more to The Economist. It's not just about economics and finance. It covers a range of subjects. And if you would like to see what The Economist has to offer, you can get a print copy delivered to your door by texting the word cycling to 78070. That's cycling to 78070.
The Cycling Podcast at the 2019 Tour de France is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport for supporting the Cycling Podcast as ever. You can get 25% off all your Science in Sport products with the code. Now, we got you to do this in French last night, Francois, and when I listened back to the podcast, I realized you'd said the number incorrectly. That's not because your French isn't good enough. So the code is, Lionel, the robot, please.
SISCP25.
At scienceandsport.com. You can't see Lionel actually doing the hand movements when he does that. But yes, thank you very much indeed to...
I can do it in French properly now. SISCP25.
25, thank you. Not 215. It's not 215% off. A rush on Science and Sport products over the last 24, 48 hours. Before we hear the next question, just a wee reminder that we have got some events coming up at the World Championships in September in Yorkshire. We're doing the biggest event we've ever done on the Friday evening. What's the venue called again? Sorry, Lionel's at the Royal Hall in Harrogate, and lots of tickets have been sold for that, so we're looking forward to a really good evening, but there are lots of tickets left. So go to thecyclingpodcast.com. down the side of our homepage you'll see live events, click on that and it'll take you through to the page where you can buy tickets for our event. It'll be me, Lionel, Francois, Daniel Freib and others. And we've also got some events in November, more to announce, but at the moment we've got St David's Hall in Cardiff on Tuesday the 12th of November, the Belfast MAC on Friday the 15th of November, Leicester Y Theatre on Thursday the 28th of November, the Arts Theatre in London on 18th and 25th of November, and the Royal Northern College of Music in Manchester on Saturday the 30th of November. Royal Northern College of Music, we'll have to get Francois to that one, I think, because he's a musician, so he can sing and play some instruments up on stage. Not really, Francois, don't worry. On with the next question.
Hey, Cycling Podcast. This is Harris from Boston, long-time listener. I'm interested in the relationship or interaction you guys have with other international media on the tour. Obviously, we hear how you guys interact and see with some of the other European or American and English-speaking media, but I'm wondering if you have a relationship with any of the other more global media that show up even specifically for the tour, and if you see some of the same faces year after year, or any of the media contingent from more far-flung parts of the world that might only show up for the Tour de France, and how that might have changed year over year. Thanks.
We certainly see the same faces year after year. I guess there are some that you don't see and you don't realize you don't see them, but there are faces that have been there every year since I've been coming to the tour. I don't know if it's the same for you, Francois.
Oh yeah, I mean, some, even we're talking about Colombian colleagues, I mean, especially on this tour, a special homage to them because they've been there for a long time now without a Colombian winner, and now, you know, they could actually let their emotions flow when Egan Bernal won. There is one, I don't know his name, a Colombian colleague, I think he works for Radio Caracol. I've always seen him around since 1986 when I covered my first tour. Yes, and some of them, you know, some of the colleagues you don't see anymore, well, it's just because they... Well, some retired, some passed away. I have a very something that moved me a couple of years back. I mean, when I was started doing my first tours, I had my rucksack and I didn't always have a car. And one day I think it was in late 80s. I was interviewing Stephen Roach on the start line and kind of missed the start. And I had to run on top of the race to try and get to my car, but I couldn't. And the car stopped, and it was a Colombian colleague from the El Globo, his newspaper was. I jumped in the car, and we became great friends. He was very, very nice, and I learned that actually he was a political journalist, and a couple of years later, well, 15 years later, I read the story, saw his picture, he'd been killed in, political warfare in Colombia. So, yeah, that's the kind of relationship you have with these guys. Some have always been around, like Gianni Mura, the Italian journalist, works for La Repubblica. I think he started covering the tour in the late 60s. So, I mean, you know, some of them are kind of... I know that Gianni, unfortunately, it sounds a little bit grim what I'm saying just now, but I mean, he buried three drivers, you know, in along his career because, I mean, he's been covering the tour for nearly 50, yeah, more than 50 years now. So, yeah, so some of them are still around. Some of them you don't even know their names, but you only see them on the tour. Some Japanese colleagues, Danish colleagues. It's kind of I wouldn't say big, happy family, but we know each other. We kind of the Francophones, we tutoie, we use tu, which is for friends, you know. So yes, it's a big community. I mean, so sometimes it happened to me that I met some of these guys on holidays in remote places, and I know you. Oh yeah, you know me, and all of a sudden, you covered the tour. So we don't always know their names, but they're colleagues. And finally, there is an association of cycling journalists called the AIJC. So there's also from time to time meetings of all these people from all over the world. They try to be as international as they can to have representatives in every continent. So yeah, there is a how could I say, it's a body of people, you know, working together.
Gianni Mura only just got rid of his typewriter, didn't he? I think he switched onto a laptop finally. But I mean, it's one of the great things that the best source of information about a particular country or a particular rider is always the journalist from that country. So if a Dutch rider is doing well, you'll speak to your Dutch colleagues. Colombian rider is doing well, you'll try and speak to your Colombian colleagues, and one or two of them do speak English. But that's very rewarding. And over the last few years, we British journalists have been, I suppose, a lot more in demand among our colleagues, because they will come to you and ask you about, you know, for some background on Geraint Thomas or Bradley Wiggins. And it's probably brought the British journalists into the fold a little bit more, because for many years it would have been a very one-way kind of relationship with us or whoever was covering the tour, asking about the French writers, the Spanish writers, and so on. And it's kind of gone the other way a bit.
Yeah, I was just going to say, actually, Philippe Brunel, our legendary colleague from the press room, you were talking about him on a recent podcast, Richard, a very striking man. I'm stunned, really, to discover from Francois that he's almost at retirement age. I mean, he looks a good 10 years younger than that. But he's got sort of shoulder-length black hair. He always dresses in black. He doesn't wear the official yellow, bright yellow cloth lanyard, does he? He replaces that with an elegant silver chain. So he has his press pass on a elegant silver chain instead. Always wears black trousers, pointy black shoes, and a black T-shirt. A very striking look. And for the first time, I've been coming to the tour since 1999. For the first time, he acknowledged me in the press room and shook my hand, and it was a real moment. I think he must have seen me hanging out with Francois, and that's where the kind of connection goes. Well, if he knows Francois, he must be okay. But there, it's a remarkable place, and I must admit, you wake up the morning after and it feels like school has broken up and you've got the 6 weeks holiday before where you're not going to see your friends again. I mean, I'm not saying we're not all friends, but we're friends within this weird community, because we're all doing the same thing in a way. We're all driving around France and getting stuck at the autoroute payage and eating sandwiches at the petrol station and wondering if there'll be some food at the buffet and trying to get our material at the team buses. And we're all going on this same journey together. So when it comes to an end, it does feel a little bit like there's something missing.
Well, somebody I spoke to on the Champs-Élysées after the final stage was Murain Zeman, the coach at Jumbo-Visma, or one of the coaches. We spoke to him at length over the winter for our Friends special on Jumbo-Visma, Chasing Sky, that episode was called. I thought Zeman was really interesting talking about his work with the team, in particular with Stephen Kruijswijk, who has finished third in this tour, his first podium in a Grand Tour. Very interested as well to hear Zeman talk about the Vuelta and the team that they will probably send to the Vuelta, which is only a few weeks away. So let's hear now from Murain Zeman, the coach at Team Jumbo-Visma.
We spoke over the winter about your plans for the year, and with Stephen in particular.
Yep.
How do you reflect on his podium place finally in a Grand Tour?
Yeah, well, amazing, of course. Finally, he's on the podium, and finally, he will enjoy here in the biggest race of the world that he's there with the best riders in the world. So, yeah, it makes me very proud that that he achieves it, and after so many years of hard work, that he succeeded. So that's absolutely, yeah, fantastic. Yeah,
and that's two podiums in the two Grand Tours so far for the team this year.
Yeah. It's an incredible season. Yeah, I think we are on the good way. Like we discussed in the winter, we try to build this team, and yeah, we want to be the best of the world, and we have to find out how we can do that. And yeah, we have to put a lot of work and energy in it all together, and I think we're on the right way, and one more Grand Tour to come, so that yeah, would be fantastic if we can achieve that we are on all the Grand Tours, we are on the podium.
We saw a lot of Laurens de Ploeg and George Bennett here as well, so he had seen a lot of support in the mountains. Arguably a stronger team in the mountains than Team Ineos. That must be very satisfying to see.
Yep, yeah, absolutely. And I think in the Vuelta we're going to see a very strong climbing team. Yeah, there we want to show it again. But I think, yeah, we have very good guys in the mountains, but also young talents coming with Sepp Kuss and Tolhoek and Bouwman. And so there's also the next generation is also within the team already. So I'm confident for the coming years. Yeah.
And can Stephen still improve, do you think? Because, you know, he's been trying for several years to get on the podium. He's made it, but can he still improve?
Yeah, difficult to say. I think he's on an incredible high level. He improved over the years. We're going to try it again this winter, and we keep pushing to find ways to make him better. And of course, it's in the details because he is so disciplined. And yeah, I think he's on a very high level, so we see. But in the winter. It's always in the winter that you have to do it and to make it happen, and that's what we're going to try again. Yeah.
Just finally, you mentioned the Vuelta a couple of times. It's obviously a big target for you. Who's going to be leading the team there?
Yeah, well, Primoz for sure, and we have to discuss also with George and Stevie how we're going to make the final race plan. So yeah, anyway, we that's something what we have to figure out, but obviously Primoz for sure will lead because he's also fresh, he's coming from altitude, and we're going to discuss it with Stevie and George how they see it and make the best possible plan.
Stephen rode both last year and actually maybe even rode better at the Vuelta than at the Tour.
Yeah, that's true, but now he finishes on the podium. I think in Holland it will be quite hectic. A lot of people want something from him, so he has to find his rest, and then we see what will happen.
Hi, Cycling Podcast. This is Nicola from Bathgate. Shout out to the West Lothian Clarion Cycling Club, and thank you to all the listeners who bought mugs in support of the West Lothian Cycle Circuit project. My question relates to the group of French and international amateur female cyclists who are riding the Tour de France a day ahead of the Tour. I wondered if you'd come across them over the last couple of weeks, and I'd be interested to hear them interviewed on the podcast. I'd like to ask for your thoughts on their campaign for a women's Tour de France stage race. It is a noble push towards equality, but having become a more knowledgeable fan of women's cycling recently, I do like that the women's calendar has its standalone events, and I'm excited about the new Scandinavian stage race and the ever-expanding Tour of Britain. But then the Tour de France is so iconic, perhaps it could and should showcase women cycling more. Just how would this work logistically without the women always looking like they're in the shadows. Thanks for your thoughts and hope to see you in Linlithgow for the cycle circuit opening.
Well, thanks very much for your question, Nicola. We are currently on our way to Paris and I'm going to be meeting up on the Champs-Élysées with some of the internationals. I've been keeping in touch with Helen Sharp and Louise Gibson, who featured in the episode of the cycling podcast Femina that went out just before the Tour de France. And I'll be catching up with them this afternoon, but I'll be keeping in touch with them. I don't know this yet for sure. You might know this better than me, but I think the women have completed the route of the Tour de France, unlike the men, which is interesting. But yeah, I mean, you make some interesting points, and we'll be covering some of these in the next episode of the cycling podcast Femina. But I spoke to Julien Pretot, the Reuters journalist, who wrote a story on the day of La Course about a new event that ASO are planning. They've set up a department to look at developing women's cycling, and the idea seems to be to establish a stage race for women. Now, whether this will be called the Tour de France, I don't know. I'm pretty sure, well, I'm 100% sure it will not be held at the same time as the Tour de France. It may be in June or September, or, you know, but sometime outside of the Tour de France. I'm also sure it won't be 3 weeks. But nevertheless, if ASO are looking to develop this, well, when I spoke to Julien Pretot about it, he says it's because they will see an opportunity to make money out of it, which I think is a very positive sign in terms of how they view women's cycling and where it's at in its development. So one or two things seem to have changed recently, because there was some talk earlier in the year about Liège-Bastogne-Liège and Flèche-Wallonne not being on the Women's World Tour next year because ASO were not guaranteeing live television coverage. But this dispute seems to have been resolved. They will be on TV next year and they will be part of the Women's World Tour. So something seems to have changed at ASO, I think, in terms of their approach to women's cycling. And I agree with you that the iconic status of the Tour de France means that a women's Tour de France has a certain appeal that will transcend anything that the new Scandinavian race might be able to offer, or even the women's tour. But it is a tricky question, how to sort of accommodate women's cycling within what's already a very crowded calendar for women as well. Where would this new race be? At the moment, the Giro Rosa is probably the premier race for women, but it clashes with the Tour de France, and that means it doesn't get as much coverage as it would do otherwise. I don't know if you have any thoughts, Lionel.
Well, you mentioned the Giro Rosa running at the same time as the Tour de France, and people often ask, why is there such a, on the face of it, a crazy clash of schedules? But for the Italian market, it works quite well, because it means that the broadcaster that shows the Tour de France can then show a package, a daily package from the Giro Rosa, and in Italy give it arguably a higher profile than it would ordinarily have had. And that's kind of a historical thing, and we have seen this year moves towards certainly online live daily coverage of the Giro Rosa, I think, certainly highlights as well. But then there's still this perennial problem of not just the entire cycling media's focus being on the Tour de France, but the sporting media's focus being on the Tour de France. And so it's going to be very, very difficult for any event that isn't the Tour de France to get coverage in July. So ASO looking to develop something that can stand alone and stand on its own two feet and develop a reputation and a standing of its own, I think has to be a positive.
Yeah, if I can just add a little bit of a precisions about all that, I talked to a very important source at ASO about that issue, and what he told me, ASO are a pride. There's a misconception that ASO are kind of like FIFA for football, organizing the World Cup. They're not. They're a private company. The sport is run by the UCI, and it's the role of the UCI to promote women's cycling. It's not the role of ASO. And for sure, I'm not defending that option. I'm just stating a fact. They're a private company trying to make a profit. But that source ASO told me, even if we organize women's races and we lose money on them, we will do it because it will enhance the brand ASO, and it will also improve our image. So we have to do it because of the image that we, that the company wants to have. So that's also one of the reasons why they're now being more sensitive to women's cycling, knowing that it might not be profitable straight away, but it might be in the future. The example of Giro Rossa is very interesting. Giro Rossa, unlike its name would have, it is not organized by the organizers of the Giro d'Italia, meaning that I totally support the campaign for a women's Tour de France, but it doesn't mean that ASO should be in the organizers. You know, if they show a reluctance to do it, why not go to another organizer or others find sponsors to you know? I remember the days of La Route de France, because women's Tour de France have existed in the past and unfortunately didn't last because of the profitability of it. But there was one race called La Route de France, which was not organized by ASO, and it was called La Route de France because of the copyright on the name Tour de France. So, like the tennis women did with the WTA in the 1970s with Billie Jean King, I think it would be it's essential that women cyclists and you know get organized and find sponsors, find personalities to try and find the money and find the organizers who can, you know, create their own circuit, and it'll be probably more efficient than trying to lure ASO, who are reluctant to do so, into organizing the Tour de France.
Final point on that. Funny you should mention Billie Jean King, because there's a very interesting article, an interview with Iris Slappendel, the retired Dutch rider, in the magazine Outside, American magazine, where she's actually compared to, well, she's called cycling's Billie Jean King. She set up the Cyclist Alliance with another couple of riders, and it's a sort of trade union, but a campaigning body and a representative body for female riders, which in only a couple of years has done some pretty incredible work, actually. And Iris Slappendel could be one of the women who does exactly what you say, Francois. Well, fellas, that's us. We're done. Thank you very much again, Francois. We did our thank yous and goodbyes last night. We did our thanks to other people who've helped with the podcast, but thanks once again from us.
Yeah, thanks to you for having me on, and well, safe trip back, and well, hopefully I see you pretty soon in Harrogate, or even before in the Cycling Podcast Grand Tour.
Well, yeah, I was going to say I'll see you in 11 months and 1 week, but we'll see you before then. Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
And before we go, final few thanks. It all sounds very final, doesn't it? We will actually be back with a regular episode next week. And with other episodes coming up, we've got an episode of Service Course coming up, the second episode of that. We've got an episode of the Cycling Podcast Femina coming up, and a few friend specials.
We've certainly got, the Giro Rosa Diaries from a couple of riders who were racing there earlier this month. We've got a Lunch With episode that was recorded during the tour. And we've got the road trip, if we can filter the...
If we can salvage something from all the nonsense that we've recorded along the way. I'm not sure we can, but we'll give it a good go.
Legal fees might add up a bit on that one.
Yeah, but thank you to Friends of Podcast. If you sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com, you can get access to all these special episodes and the ones that have been released earlier in the year. Lots of you have been signing up during the Tour de France, so thank you very much to you. And I'm sure part of the incentive is just because you want your name read out at the end of the episode. So a big thanks to Christopher Metcalf, Lewis Morrison, Ian Simpson, Andy South, Gordon McBain, P. Hartley, James Hughes.
And thank you to Keith Warner, Michael Miss Kelly, Nicanor Hopkins, Andrew Williams, John Jackson, Simon Davis, Dominic Laval, and Peter de Kock.
And a big thanks to Howard Sprange, Joe Horobin, Chris Cobble, Paul Wilkinson, Tony Roberts, Marcus Culey, Connor Wynne, David Edwards, Simon Lockwood, Peter Haykowski, Benjamin Havel, Mark Wakeling, and Kevin Mitz.
I thought you're going to go on forever there, Francois. Just carry on. Thank you very much to you all. Sign up to become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. It's au revoir from the Tour de France. Well, the thank yous go on, Lionel, don't they? We're speeding towards Cali. Well, we're driving within the speed limit towards Cali. We want to say a few more thank yous to Simon Lund, who for the second year in a row allowed us to stay in his fantastic house in the Alps, close to the stage that didn't quite finish in team. We had a really lovely evening there, and Simon was very generous in his hospitality.
Earlier in the tour, we stayed with, well, thanks to David Hesketh, at the Laurent Perrier Champagne House, and we had an amazing evening there. It was just sort of a stunning evening that took us all aback, really. And we were bowled over by the hospitality and generosity of David and his colleagues at Laurent Perrier. I want to say a thanks again to Stacey Snyder, who produced two batches of her handmade limited edition mugs, which raised money, lots of money, for the West Lothian Cycle Circuit and the David Carey Scholarship Fund in Virginia. And we're really grateful to Stacey, and also to all of you who bought mugs. Sorry for those who tried and couldn't get one. We'll be selling mugs again at the Vuelta, but it's been a great experience working with Stacey on those, and very gratifying to know that so many of you own these lovely mugs, and that these good causes have been able to get so much money as a result of your generosity. Finally, before we go and end our Tour de France coverage from 2019, a very important announcement. We have a winner of the Austin Cycles Atto folding bike, the carbon fibre machine that I've been using throughout the last 3 weeks. A fantastic bike worth £2,775. It really is the, I don't know, Lamborghini of folding bikes. I'm not a car person, so I'm not sure if that's a good comparison or not. I hope it is. Our winner, because his two entries made us laugh the most, is Gordon Booth.
Gordon Booth. Two entries from him, both of them worth reading out. When the Lionel Flanders does his bit, outside the team bus is a big hit, but the buff only moans. It's rubbish, he groans, and Francois just thinks it's bullshit. Also from Gordon Booth, Lionel loves food, don't forget. The press buffet he hasn't missed yet, but his jaw really dropped the moment he copped that the chef only served andouillette.
Oh, that's good.
Fantastic entries there, Gordon. Well done. What a talented chap.
Congratulations, Gordon. We had literally thousands of entries, we appreciate all of your entries. Lots of them moved us. Some of them made us laugh. But Gordon's made us howl with laughter, as you probably heard in that clip. So congratulations, Gordon. And we'll be in touch to arrange delivery of the wonderful Austin Cycles Atto folding bike. And thanks very much to Austin Cycles for letting me poodle about France for the last few weeks on this wonderful machine.